Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What was the line from that Tom Cruise movie? Show me the...
Show me the money!
Jerry, you better yell!
Show me the money!
The housing industry is starting to do just that. From American Public Media, you had me at hello. This is Marketplace.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 8th of August. Good to have you with us. And let's pause as we begin, shall we, to offer thanks for the rebound of the American housing market. All right. Rebound is perhaps too strong a word. Let's try at least the bleeding has stopped, because both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government-controlled, taxpayer-bailed-out mortgage firms, said this week they are making money. They're both going to pay back some of the cash they borrowed from taxpayers and, fingers crossed, help housing get at least part of the way back. Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets us going today.
Freddie and Fannie nearly collapsed when the housing market tanked. Now, rising home prices are reintroducing black ink to the firms. And those rising prices might, just might, mark the beginning of a change in the mortgage market for consumers. Right now,
one of the things we're seeing are extremely tight mortgage underwriting standards out there.
Guy Sakala is the publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance.
And that's clearly keeping a lot of would-be home buyers and mortgage refinancers out of the marketplace.
Basically, lenders freak when prices fall.
Because they're taking on greater risk as your housing price declines.
Professor Ken Caro teaches at the Kelly School of Business. But he says when housing prices go up, lenders shake off that fear and make more loans.
So that makes it easier access for credit in the future.
Which means this could be, and I stress could, the beginning of what Professor Susan Wachter calls a virtuous cycle in the housing market. She teaches real estate and finance at Wharton.
With the fear fading, lenders come into the market with more financing availability. There are more loans that are closing, more homes are purchased, and prices rise.
And then the cycle starts again. Higher prices, more lenders, more loans, more buyers, higher prices. And yes, higher prices can be good up to a point. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
All right, stop what you're doing for a second. Close your eyes if it's safe. And imagine this. You walk into a coffee shop. You got your smartphone in your pocket. You order your tall drip or whatever it is that gets you through the day. And instead of asking you for $2 or $3 or $4, the cashier just asks your name and sends you on your way. It's cool, right? Starbucks, we learned last night, is teaming up with a mobile payment company, Square, to make that scenario a reality. No credit card, no fumbling for change, and maybe, eventually, a cashless world. Marketplace's Queenie Kim takes a look.
Starbucks is no stranger to mobile payments. About a year ago, it put out a mobile app that lets you pay for your latte by swiping your phone in front of a scanner. Howard Schultz is the CEO of Starbucks.
When we introduced mobile commerce, I just don't think we had any idea that we would see such a robust level of acceptance so quickly.
Today, customers make about 1 million of these mobile transactions a week. And Starbucks' success and its new partnership with Square has people crowing again that the cashless and credit cardless future is near. But is the Starbucks news really a game changer?
I think in these early iterations of these products, it isn't life-changing or life-saving technologies we're seeing. It's added convenience.
David Woolman is the author of The End of Money. He says to imagine a cashless society, look to Kenya, where people have little access to credit cards and banking. More and more, when you need to send money to the next village, you walk to your corner store, plunk down cash, and the shopkeeper texts the money to the store in the next village.
It's just hard to do.
Lee Rainey is the director of the Pew Research Center's Internet in American Life Project.
This is not a trivial problem. Get all these systems to talk to each other for different merchants who have different expectations.
And when it comes to making large purchases, consumers in the U.S. want to know that there are laws to protect them. And he says that future's a long way off. I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
At the corner of Wall Street and Broad today in Lower Manhattan, boy, it was a whole lot of meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, just as a rough working estimate, a zillion or so moving parts in a healthcare law. Individual mandates, mandatory coverages, lots of stuff. One of the big parts is Medicaid. States can choose to expand their coverage for the poor and disabled, or they can choose not to under the healthcare law. But if they do expand it and enroll people who earn up to 133% of the poverty level, the federal government will pick up basically the entire bill for the new recipients. The state of Oregon has tried health care reform before with mixed results. So now it's trying something new. From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Here's something you don't hear every day. A government official looking forward to adding another 200,000 poor and disabled people to his state's Medicaid rolls. Bruce Goldberg directs the Oregon Health Authority, which oversees Medicaid in the state.
Having uninsured people come on to Medicaid brings in access to care, brings in dollars. We know that coverage helps people remain more financially stable and healthier. May not be the best dollars, but better than no dollars.
Maybe not the best dollars because of all the federal strings attached, but better than no dollars because healthcare spending knows only one direction, up.
The Affordable Care Act has brought a mechanism to address the coverage part. That's unsustainable unless we address the cost aspect,
which is rising at triple the rate of inflation. This month, Oregon rolled out an ambitious makeover of its Medicaid system based on Coordinated Care Organizations, or CCOs. Medicaid patients will now get all their care through a regional CCO. It gives them a single per-patient budget to coordinate care. Most important, the new CCOs will target the highest-cost patients, the ones with chronic conditions like heart disease and diabetes. It's these people who end up in the hospital again and again at hundreds or thousands of dollars a pop, all paid for by the taxpayer.
20% of the population account for about 80% of the cost. And what we need to do is manage those illnesses better, move the care to a higher quality, lower cost setting.
Like a primary care clinic instead of a high-priced specialist's office, the ER, or if things go really bad, the ICU. To see Oregon's CCO pilot program in action, I've come to Portland's Northeast Health Center. It's a busy county clinic. Social worker Amy Vance is one of the new community care coordinators responsible for helping patients navigate the system.
So an example is I have a young woman, she had uncontrolled diabetes, who was being admitted to the hospital about twice a month.
With her insulin out of control, her kidneys were failing.
So I would go to the hospital, we would talk, and it made her come to the realization that her diet was at play. And so we started cooking at her house.
And shopping for healthy food instead of deep-fried takeout. The patient started keeping her doctor's appointments.
And she hasn't gone to the hospital in 2 months.
Medical emergencies averted, health and well-being restored, taxpayer money saved. Sounds simple, but nothing is simple when it comes to Medicaid. Medicaid funding still needs to be funneled through insurance systems that pay doctors and hospitals for everything they do. It's all done by code.
Which department pays its claims, its administration?
Freddie Senhauser is a manager at a new CCO serving Southern Oregon, and he attended a recent coordinated care summit. He's confused about how to bill for a diabetic's cooking lesson or an air conditioner paid for by Medicaid to prevent an old lady from going into congestive heart failure every time it gets hot.
Is there no code for it?
No code.
Which is why, before Oregon could even roll out its new coordinated care organization statewide, it had to get a complicated waiver from the feds to bend the incredibly Byzantine rules governing Medicaid coverage. Terry Coughlin studies healthcare reform at the Urban Institute. She says Oregon is a pioneer, the first state to put its entire Medicaid caseload into coordinated care to try and bend the cost curve for public health spending down.
That is the million-dollar question, whether the CCOs can fulfill the promise of improving quality and tackle cost and really lower the trend line. That's the hope. That's the goal.
Actually, it's more like a $1.9 billion question. That's how much additional federal money Oregon is getting to revamp the insurance reimbursement system, add codes for cooking lessons and air conditioners and the like, plus monitor patient health and hire more medical workers. And there are a lot of strings attached. The state has to hit ambitious cost-saving goals, cut the rate at which Medicaid spending rises to about half the national average. Miss the mark, and taxpayers here are on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars in penalties to the federal government. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I had a conversation on the show Monday with a guy named John Metcalf about an article he'd written on cardboard theft, in which I learned a little something.
People just ganking their cardboard.
I'm sorry, ganking their cardboard? Is that a word?
Yeah, just stealing it right off the right off the curb.
Who knew I was so lame, right? You guys had some fun with that on our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. So we asked you for some of your favorite slang words, in this case, for money.
Money, usually followed by in da bank.
Scratch. Guac.
Cha-ching!
I shell out clams for the things I want most.
Okane. That's Japanese.
Paper, cheddar, stacks.
Skrilla.
Dead presidents. Franklins. Grants. Jacksons. Even Washingtons.
So we've taken all of those and some more and put them together in something we're calling an urban finance dictionary. Find it at marketplace.org. Send us yours as well. Coming up.
Skydiving is fun enough. You're having a good time. And, you know, why would you add that extra element of risk?
The Freakonomics of summertime fun. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials nudged higher 7 points today, less than 0.1%, hit 13,175. The NASDAQ, though, off 4 points, 0.1%, 3,011. The S&P 500 was up. Less than a point, though, finished at 1402. Investors heaped a cornucopia of attention on Dean Foods. It reported better-than-expected earnings, and shares fattened up more than 40%, 40%. Elsewhere, Hewlett-Packard longed into a gain of almost 0.2%. The computer maker lifted its earnings forecast for the third quarter. Aluminum maker Alcoa brightened up 0.2%, while Disney scurried higher more than 0.3% following its latest earnings report. On the negative side, shares of Priceline lost more than 17% today. That after the online travel site lowered its third-quarter earnings projections. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Earnings season continues. We'll get the latest from the fast food folks at Wendy's. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, will meet to talk about this year's hurricane season. And happy birthday to Gillian Anderson. You know her best as the red-headed partner to Agent Fox Mulder in The X-Files. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are, as we all know, only 24 hours in a day. And as a corollary to that, there's only so much television ad space available in prime time. So the news today that an outside group supporting Republican candidates is launching a multi-million dollar television campaign in key swing states comes as bad news to local car dealers, small businesses, and other wannabe advertisers in those states. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Has it been a while since you've heard something like this?
Make your best offer sale!
Come down and give me your best offer!
Commercials like this one for a Virginia tire store may be missing from your airwaves if you live in one of the swing states on the front line of the campaign ad wars. One reason, with all the competition for primetime TV ad slots, prices go up, way up. says Matt Lauer of the ad agency Corvus Communications.
Some local businesses are having to spend 50 or 60% more on their ad budgets.
Still, broadcasters try to accommodate their local advertisers, shoehorning their ads into less coveted TV turf. National Association of Broadcasters spokesman Dennis Wharton says TV stations don't want to hurt their long-term relationships with local advertisers.
It's much like a marriage. You want to be faithful to your partner who's with you 12 months out of the year, as opposed to this sort of fling with a super PAC.
Still, some of these marriages do show strain after a fling with a super PAC floozy.
We're just not going to get caught up in it, you know.
Tammy Darvish is planning to take a break from her local TV station. Darvish is vice president of Darcar's Automotive Group with dealerships in Virginia. She says TV ad prices will go up a bit after Labor Day, but her big beef is her ads will be lost in the ad war crossfire.
Our focus is on, are we able to break through a lot of clutter so customers really hear our message?
Darvish won't place any TV ads from Labor Day to Election Day, putting all of her advertising dollars into Google search ads. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Chiquita, the banana people, reported a 92% drop in quarterly profits yesterday. Perhaps not coincidentally, the company announced the departure of its chairman and CEO at the same time. Those who don't follow the banana industry closely might know Fernando Aguirre from the reality television show Undercover Boss, the one where CEOs pretend to be entry-level workers at their own companies. It turns out for CEOs and regular people alike, reality TV has its risks and its rewards. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
There have been 44 bosses featured on Undercover Boss. At least three of them are, well, no longer bosses.
It's probably an average mortality rate, so to speak.
Ralph Ward is the publisher of newsletter Boardroom Insider. Still, is it a good idea for a company to show its top decision maker looking a little bit incompetent, like in this recent episode?
I would not let Tom loose in a customer's house.
Tom is actually Chad Halleck, CEO of Budget Blinds. He was trying to help install Venetian blinds. Halleck says looking a little silly really paid off for his company.
A huge sales bump. I can't even almost describe. We had to prepare our servers.
We've estimated we probably saw about a $25 million increase to system-wide sales.
That's Shelley Sun, CEO and co-founder of Bright Star Care, a home health care provider. After she went on Undercover Boss, her sales jumped by nearly 20%.
However pudgy I might look in a pair of scrub pants, you know, I had to be willing to, you know, forego that sense of humility for the greater good.
Boardroom Insider's Ralph Ward says these days people don't want an all-knowing CEO. They want a person they can feel connected to.
It certainly builds humanity for the corporation. To actually see the CEO struggling with this or making a doof of himself doing that.
Still, as Chiquita shows, the CEO had better deliver in his day job. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The Centers for Disease Control says more than two-thirds of all the adults in this country are overweight or obese, a solid customer base, it would seem, for the weight loss industry. And yet both Nutrisystem and Weight Watchers have reported subpar earnings the past week or 10 days. And Marketplace's Amy Scott reports there is another competitor out there as well.
I didn't have to look far to find someone trying to slim down.
Hi!
Sarah Whips takes care of my son during the day.
So my wedding is coming up in September, and I want to float down the aisle a little bit versus, you know, feel subconscious about it.
After breakfast, she opens an app on her iPhone called Lose It. She searches its huge database of ingredients and restaurant foods, enters a cup of cottage cheese and a peach, and voila.
So my breakfast was like 228 calories. So I have 1,201 calories left for the day.
Weight Watchers offers a similar program with a $20 a month subscription, and its online business is growing. But apps like Lose It and MyFitnessPal are free, John LaRosa tracks the diet industry at Market Data Enterprises. He says there's another threat looming. The FDA recently approved two prescription diet pills that will come on the market soon. LaRosa says Weight Watchers' biggest competitor has always been the do-it-yourself diet, but he says a lot of people need the face-to-face support of counseling and meetings with other dieters.
When the economy improves and people's income improves, I think we will see a return to some of the more costly structured programs with meetings, but we're not there yet.
Online apps have another appeal. At his heaviest, novelist Harry Connolly weighed 300 pounds. His wife had been after him to sign up for Weight Watchers or Jenny Craig.
The truth is, I was embarrassed. This was something private that I could do kind of quietly at home and never tell anyone about.
Until he succeeded, that is. Connolly says last year he lost 40 pounds using a $3 iPad app, and so far he's kept it off. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, it is so good to talk to you again, man.
And to you, Kai. I missed you, too. How's your summer been?
Good. Busy, but good.
Good. Tis, of course, the season for outdoor activity, some of which I'm here to tell you can have a very significant downside.
What, like sunburn and mosquito? But what?
No, I'm actually talking about death. So I hate to be a killjoy in the middle of summer.
Okay.
But I thought it might be worthwhile to look at the relative danger of some of America's favorite summertime activities.
All right.
Okay, so let's start with motorcycling. Here's Randa Samaha from the National Crash Analysis Center.
Okay.
Motorcyclists are very vulnerable road users. For every 100 million vehicle mile traveled, there are over 24 riders killed.
So when I was 20-something years old, I told my grandfather that I wanted to buy a motorcycle, and he said, I would sooner kill you with my bare hands. He was a doctor.
Good advice, yeah. Okay. I don't know if you own a boat, Kai,
no.
The boating statistics are a little bit frightening. Here's Mike Barron with the U.S. Coast Guard.
We're roughly down to about, say 6.2 deaths per every 100,000 boats.
And swimming, something most of us do. I do a lot of that in the summer. Here's Julie Gilchrist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Overall, the drowning rate in the United States for all ages is 1.29 per 100,000.
Huh. And I couldn't find any stats on golfing deaths. That's what I spend, my free time. I think that's relatively safe. But skydiving, here's Nancy Corrine from the U.S. Parachute Association.
Wow. There's been an average of maybe 22 fatalities a year. Which is about 7 per 1 million skydives.
Okay, wait. So 7 per million versus all those others,
not so many.
No, not so bad, right?
So, the motorcycle death rate is based on the number of miles traveled. Swimming deaths, meanwhile, are counted on a per capita basis. Skydiving deaths based on the number of jumps. And, of course, a lot fewer people go skydiving every year than go swimming.
Help me out here, though, Freakonomics Obi-Wan. What is the message here? I know what it is. We're scared of the wrong thing.
That is exactly right. Human beings are generally quite bad at assessing risk. We tend to get worried about the big anomalous events, shark attacks, for instance,
Because they're scary.
Well, they are scary and they get a lot of news coverage. And then when they get a lot of news coverage, we're convinced that they're a lot more common than they are. 5 people on average worldwide die from unprovoked shark attacks. Meanwhile, in the U.S. alone, in a given year, 4,500 people die from motorcycle accidents and another 4,000 or so from drowning.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I could step off the curb in front of Marketplace Global Headquarters here this afternoon on my way to get a
God
cup of coffee.
God forbid, but yes, you could.
And I could be hit by a bus. I mean, what am I supposed to do?
Well, you're going to do what you want to
yes,
do.
Yes, I am. Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying you should be overly scared of things you shouldn't be, but there is a lot to learn at looking at these numbers, just taking a step back and doing it. One piece of data that really jumps out at you is this: the ability of alcohol to help make bad things happen. Okay, so listen to this. About 30% of all motorcyclists who died were legally drunk. The Coast Guard tells us that alcohol was the primary contributing factor in about 16% of the boating fatalities.
What about skydiving? I mean, people don't drink and skydive, do they?
You know, there are no hard and fast stats on it. We did ask, here's Nancy Kareen again from the Parachute Association.
For the most part, skydivers aren't really interested in doing that kind of thing. Skydiving is fun enough. You're having a good time. And, you know, why would you add that extra element of risk?
You know, Kai, this raises an interesting point. If an activity is prima facie dangerous, maybe it scares people away from adding a layer of danger by drinking, you know?
Hang on a minute, right? Because motorcycling is prima facie, although I always thought it was prima facie, but it's prima facie dangerous, but people drink and motorcycle all the time.
Well, to some people it is, and to some people plainly it's not. I mean, I tend to agree with you, especially riding bike without a helmet. You know, helmets are estimated to prevent about 40% of crash deaths among motorcyclists, and yet there are a lot of bikers out there who would much prefer to ride a bike than to not, and to ride a bike without a helmet. Look, if safety is your number one concern this summer, I'm not saying it should be, but if it is, I've got the ultimate activity for you and everybody.
All right, what's
out
up?
There.
Hit me with it.
You stay inside, you listen to your radio.
Stephen Dubner.
Taking the coward's way out. Yeah.
That's right. Hey, man, I'm all right with that. Right. Freakonomics.com is the website. He's back in a couple of weeks if he stays safe out there.
God,
Dubner, we'll see you.
Tis.
Well, you got to be safe.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I am reasonably sure is this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us, Disney is offering a new service, a chance for girls ages 3 to 12 to have their likenesses photographed in 3D and then molded onto an actual princess figurine. Rapunzel, Cinderella, Snow White, the whole crew is available. $99.95 plus shipping and handling, and no, I am sadly not making this up. Today, the Dow Industrials nudged higher 7 points, barely a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ off 4 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 gained less than a point. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.